The full Will Chase experience. I love it.
The following is a production by Cutting to the Chase Podcast.
Nice to be in orbit.
Charlie Ramiliotis, what's up? It's been a while, about a year, actually. About this time last year we chatted, so what's up?
What's going on, man? I feel like it's our annual check-in. Same time, same place, same everything. So it feels like we're on track from our annual schedule.
Love that, because I know last August you said something like, yeah, we should just do it like once a year. And I'm like, hey, if you're down, I'm down. You're super chill to talk to. So it's always cool to connect. And I haven't done a podcast in like 3-4 months. So it's cool to kind of get back into it, chatting a little hockey with you.
You and me both. I haven't done a podcast in a while. And it's kind of like dusting my brain. Like I have to dust off the cobwebs because we're going to be talking hockey, and I'm sure we'll be talking league-wide stuff, and you know, and I was like, okay, I got to make sure that I'm gearing my brain back up to get ready for some hockey. So we'll see how I do. So just give me a little grace if I feel like I'm not articulating myself properly, or I have some brain farts. You know, just know that I'm still in off-season mode, but we're getting there.
Yeah, no, same on my end. I had to even just make sure when I plugged in equipment that I was doing something right, making sure everything was going to come out the way it needed to or whatever. So I totally get where you're coming from there too. But yeah, so I'm curious, before we get into the actual hockey stuff, how was your summer post, you know, the season ending and everything? And obviously we're getting ready for the new season coming up here in a bit, but you probably got away, right, in August, or kind of had a chance to get away from it all?
I did. Yeah. I was able to do like a 3-week vacation in Europe in July, and just mainly visiting family in our homeland of Greece, which was really nice. I always tell people, like, first of all, I'm blessed that I was able to do that, 'cause I know a lot of people, it's a lot of money to go to Europe and travel the world. And so, you know, but if it is on a bucket list of anyone out there, I highly recommend going totally out of the country, because it felt like when I was in Greece, being on the other side of the world, it truly felt like I was able to unplug on everything that was going on back here in the States, you know, like, 'cause you're just like on an opposite schedule, you know, it's like an 8-hour time difference, and you're like, I'm waking up, they're going to bed, they're waking up, I'm going to bed. So it was nice to kind of get away. And I honestly felt, I came back feeling really rejuvenated, and I was like, by mid-August, I was like, man, I'm ready to go again. Like, I'm like getting the itch. I feel like I got too much time on my hands. I'm getting a little bored. So I'm pretty excited to get the season going again.
You know, I think my cousin's actually about to go to Greece. I think it was Greece in December on like a tour, one of those tours that they do over there. So I know she's excited about that. But I imagine you've been to Greece before, or at least to Europe in general before.
Yeah, I have been to Greece quite a few times, especially as I was younger, as kids. Like, we have so much family, so many family members over there. So it was kind of like every other year we would go and see our family and spend most of the summer there, a large chunk of the summer there. And now, obviously, once we've gotten older, I say we, I'm a triplet. So I have a brother and a sister. Yeah, yeah. Did you not know that? Have I never shared that with you?
You know, you just as you said that, I was thinking you probably have mentioned that, but that still gets me. I'm like, wow, a triplet. Yeah. I mean, I know a twin. I know friends that are twins, so triplets even like, wow.
Yeah, so identical brother, and then I have a sister, so it's not three boys, which would have been crazy. But yeah, so like growing up, it was kind of like a regular thing for us, and then as we started to get older, and it was like, okay, we gotta go through some colleges soon. Like we kind of scaled back, and it became harder, and then obviously as you become an adult, it becomes even more difficult to line up family schedules to all be able to get away for multiple weeks at a time together. So the fact that we were able to do that this summer was like really, really, it was amazing.
Did you and your siblings go to the same college or different?
We did. Yeah. So my brother committed to college first. Then my sister followed. And then once they committed to the same college, I was like, well, I almost feel obligated to go to the same college. So all three of us did go there. It was, Man, I'm so glad I went there too. Not only just being with them, but just the opportunities that that afforded me to, at the school. Like legitimately probably would not be where I am today without going to that college at Elmhurst. It's Elmhurst College, but now it's Elmhurst University. It's a smaller D3 school here in the Chicagoland area. But yeah, all three of us, same college, made our parents happy because they were able to visit all of us at the same time. They didn't have to go around the world to see three different kids. So it was fun.
I can imagine if like one of you went to another college, like you all went to a college, but it was a different one. Like it was just one of the three that had to go somewhere else. I can imagine like the friendly ribbing that you would have gotten at, or whoever would have gotten at Thanksgiving or something.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Honestly, if it wasn't for my brother committing first, like who knows where, like what if I committed first, then maybe his decision's different or her decision, you know, it's crazy to think of the domino effect, but I'm glad it worked out the way it did.
No, that's awesome. And I was actually going to ask you before you even mentioned that about Europe and Greece, have you been over there internationally to cover hockey? Like, I'm trying to remember. I should have looked it up. I kind of forgot. But like, I'm trying to remember if the Hawks have had any of those. I don't think they have had any of those recent European, like how the NHL will start games over in Europe to begin a season, or maybe they do like a preseason or something. Mm-hmm. I think the Hawks did have one a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken. But have
they
you
did.
Covered or? Yeah,
it was in 2019. It was a 1920 season. 1920 season. Yeah. I'm almost positive 1920 season where they played an exhibition game in Berlin, Germany, and then they opened the regular season in Prague against the Flyers. And I didn't go to Germany, but I did go to Prague for 4 days to cover that and then flew home. That was an incredible trip. I will say that the weather in Prague was like rainy the entire time, so we couldn't do much sightseeing outdoors. But funny story about that trip. I after the game had ended, I think me and another writer had a flight at like 7 a.m. the next day or 8 a.m. the next day, whatever it was. 6 a.m. I don't know. It was a very early flight. So after the game, we go back to our hotel room, we change out of our clothes, whatever, we meet inside the lobby and we're like, hey, let's just go to a local bar and try to stay awake so we can sleep on the airplane because we like needed to get our body clocks adjusted, right? And so we did that. I go to the airport, we check in, whatever, we go onto the flight. I slept. I can't remember how long the flight was, probably close to 8 hours or in that range. I slept. No, it's probably longer. It's probably like 10. I slept legitimately the entire flight and I woke up with like 45 minutes left in the flight. And it was like, it was unbelievable. It was the best flight ever because I don't even remember it. And I was like, I didn't need to adjust to the time change because I had already adjusted once I landed. So it was beautiful. We planned it out perfectly.
Yeah, that's impeccable timing. I can't even imagine. I don't even think I've even been able to fall asleep on a plane. I mean, kind of get tired, rest your eyes, type of thing. But I haven't been to Europe, so I really want to go to Europe and travel and see the place, you know, see everything. But at the same time, I think about the flights and I'm thinking, man, I'd love to just not be thinking about the fact that I'm over the ocean right now. Not that it would make a difference if you're over land. I mean, either way, you don't want to, you know, but for some reason, I have sort of this fear of like, not that it would keep me from flying. I would definitely go to Europe and do things. But, you know, I'd like to kind of cut through the flight part of it. So maybe if I could sleep through a flight, that'd be nice.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that because all I want to do on flights is sleep because I get bored. I'm like, I don't know what to do on a flight. I can't have, you know, I don't access internet most of the time. Sometimes I will if I need to be on for work, but I'm just kind of like, well, I'll just sleep on the plane. So don't let the flying stop you from going. Cause it for is sure. Like, sometimes I have to remind myself of this, but like driving a car is more unsafe than being on a plane. Like if you really think about it,
it's
highly recommend going. I know it could be maybe a little bit scary flying overseas, but trust me, it's worth it.
Definitely want to. Yeah, I don't plan to let it stop me. I definitely plan to do that. And I have cousins that just moved to Hawaii, so it'd be cool to go to Hawaii at some point anyways. But no, that sounds awesome in general. But it's really cool you got to go to Greece this summer and been over there a few times at least and seeing hockey, or at least covering hockey over there as well. I was trying to think too, like any, I guess, international, like maybe not Olympic stuff, but like when the Hawks have had like internet, or I should say when the players part of the Hawks have had like international stuff happening over there, whether it's getting ready for the Olympics or whatever. I know they have like those tournaments after the season when it's like Team USA, Team Canada, Russia, all those different teams have different things going on. If you had covered anything like that over kind of internationally, or
I haven't covered anything like that. Yeah, like those world championships after it happens during the middle of the Stanley Cup playoffs. So it's kind of, it's like never worth going. And also it's hard to sell, you know, on my bosses too, like it, or just the company as a whole, like, you know, we have to operate within a budget. And so I'm not at every Blackhawks road game because we have to like work with it. Oh. So it's tough. Okay. You know, it's tough to find the balance of what games to attend. And so, yeah, never gone to Europe in that way, but it was very cool covering a Blackhawks game in Prague because it was like, you know, it was just a totally new experience. I didn't know what to expect. And so it was really fun.
I didn't even realize that you didn't travel to all the road games. Is that always been kind of how it is? Or is it mainly also because the team isn't quite up to what they were, you know, during their cup winning days? Like you probably, I don't know if you traveled more then, but has it always been kind of like that with the road and the budget and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's been, I'd say about like I go to half, maybe a little bit, like half the road games is probably a good sweet spot. And then usually if I'm not on the road, like I'll go in studio and be on the panel for the pre intermission and post game show. So that's typically how it works, you know, just so I'm not sitting at home, you know, and not, I still like to be able to contribute and be on TV and be provide some sort of value to our company too. So yeah. And I think post COVID, budget's starting to tighten up a little bit. So, and it's not just Blackhawks too. Like, you know, we have, you know, NBC had Bulls and White Sox. And so it was kind of like a larger scale budget that it wasn't just us. Like we had to be cognizant of, you know, the entire budget too.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know sometimes I have to stop and think, like, even these big companies have their own budgets and restraints, right, and things like that. It's not like, or restraints, constraints, either way. everyone's got to deal with the money in some way. So that makes sense. So yeah. Were you at the, kind of jump in here, but were you at the Blackhawks Blue Jackets game? I think it was Thanksgiving Eve last fall when the Jackets won like 7-3 or some crazy score.
I wasn't there. That was the... oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That was right before Thanksgiving, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I wasn't there. I was actually in studio doing work for there. I think it was because we didn't want to fly home on Thanksgiving morning and then I think the Hawks had a game on Friday too, so it just didn't make sense. It was like for like a quick one off. So wasn't there, but I was in studio.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's probably good that you weren't just, well, hey, because the Hawks had a terrible, well, you know, the score was not fun, probably, at least from the Blackhawk fan base side of things. But I know that was the Bedard-Fantilli game, so it was kind of a little bit hyped up in that regard. I remember the interviews they had on the Columbus side with both of them. But going into, I remember we were talking last August, about kind of the expectations, the hype, Bedard, the Hawks in general. We knew the Hawks were not going to be a great team yet, but there was all that hype for Bedard, obviously. And I know I can't remember if this was your official prediction, but I know you told me that at that time, at least back in about mid to late August, that you were kind of thinking like, you know what, Bedard over under, I think it was like 82 points. And I think you told me that the total would be 84. And would you say, based on everything you knew about Bedard going into last season, and then obviously getting to watch him pretty much every single night, whether in person or at least, you know, seeing every game he was part of, would you say that he exceeded your expectations or basically matched exactly what you were kind of expecting?
Yeah, I remember. So I did have him at 84 points. This was assuming that he was going to play all 82 games.
Yeah.
So obviously he gets hurt, fractures his jaw. He misses X amount of games, but he still wasn't on that 80 point per game pace. So I still probably would have fallen short. Well, it's funny because I had written an article like right before this regular season started and said, like, I think Connor Bedard is going to finish with a point per game or above it at 84. And then a few days later, I think it was a few days later, Frank Saravalli of the Daily Faceoff published his bold predictions. And one of his bold predictions was Connor Bedard's going to finish with 100 points. And I was like, whoa, I thought I was being bold. And I saw Frank in Pittsburgh for the morning skate on opening night. And we joked around about it because I was like, man, I thought I was being bold with 84 and you're at 100. You're making me look like I don't have, I should have shot higher. But I still think Connor Bedard would have flirted with 84 points if the Blackhawks had a healthy roster for most of the season. They, at one point midseason, had more money tied up to injured reserve than they had on the active roster because 9 players were on IR. And like Andreas Athanasiou is one of them. He's like a top 6 guy, top 9 guy. Lucas Reichel didn't produce the way we thought he was going to produce. So, you know, that obviously played a factor. The power play didn't click as much as I thought it was going to click. And so there were a lot of underlying factors, but I feel as the season went on, Connor got better and better. And when he fractured his jaw, it just took away whatever a month of the season from him to maybe have a game where he put up 4 points on a night and it, like, you know, he quickly propels him more in the direction of a point per game player. So I think with the full lineup, he maybe would have gotten to 82, like a point per game. I feel more confident about that going into this season, knowing all the moves that the Blackhawks made and the support that they surrounded Connor and some of the younger players. Are there still holes on the roster and guys playing up higher in the lineup than they probably would on contending teams? Sure. But like Tyler Bertuzzi, Teuvo Teravainen, I mean, all those players are going to, if the Blackhawks sustain some injuries this year, they're better equipped this year than last year to sustain those, to tread water. And I think Bedard isn't going to find himself in a situation where it's like him or bust, which was a majority of last season for the Blackhawks when it came to offensive production.
Yeah, and it was, even with the Hawks having a tough time on the ice, it was still like, man, Bedard is literally doing exactly what people had thought he would be doing pretty much every night. And like, yeah, I was doing the math earlier. I think he was on pace, or would have been, I guess he finished on pace for, I don't know, like 74 points or something like that. But still, rookie of the year, obvious. We kind of all knew that. I was selfishly hoping that Fantilli could at least make it a race, but of course he got hurt also. So maybe he would have, you know, he had the crazy talking about injuries. The Jackets always have injuries every summer or every season. And obviously Fantilli missed a lot of time, but guys like Dmitry Voronkov surprised and, you know, was in the top 10 scoring for the most part, I think, all year. Maybe he finished there. But yeah, as far as like Bedard, though, you know, like you said, like he wasn't on that pace for like the 84 points, but, or, you know, having an 80 point type season. But who's to say he wouldn't have, if he was able to stay healthy and, you know, obviously not have that jaw issue, if he might have had like a 5-point game or something. Like, it with him, it seemed, even with the supporting cast not being quite up to, you know, up to that snuff, it seemed possible with Bedard. Like at any time he could just go off, and whenever, I think we said this last summer, that whenever the NHL has a generational player coming into the league, it's, and like they're supposed to be generational, like Crosby and McDavid, and now guys like Bedard, it feels like they always seem to hit. You know, it's almost like it always seems to be exactly what they're built as going into that season. Like, I can't think of a guy that, I know there's been guys that don't make it, but when they're supposed to be game changers like that, it seems like they always seem to hit, and Bedard is like on that path right now.
Yeah, for sure. I think the one maybe outlier is Jack Hughes. Like, it took him a couple years to really start to pop, where we were like, oh, okay, this guy is definitely a superstar. Like, you didn't see that immediately out of the gates. I think in part because he's got a smaller frame. Like, he's tinier. He's a tinier player. Like, his frame wasn't as filled out. Whereas Connor, you looked at pictures, he's 17 years old, and you're like, holy cow, this guy has tree trunks for legs. He's ripped beyond belief. It's like, I don't know how much he's going to fill out in the NHL. Like, yeah, you could probably get a little bit stronger, but it feels like he's kind of at a good playing weight. Whereas like with Jack Hughes, it's like, okay, he probably needs a couple of years to fill out the frame, and then he's going to become an elite superstar over time. And that's exactly what happened. But yeah, most of the time when it's like a generational type prospect or someone that is like the slam dunk number one overall pick, like rarely does it feel like it doesn't work out, unless it's like a horrible circumstance. Like, you know, I don't know. Like, I think of like Nail Yakupov in Edmonton. It was just like, they kept winning the lottery and, you know, it just wasn't working out. And I think largely that it's not on the player. I think it's the culture and has everything to do with it, and like how you manage the player. So I think there are some cases where I think you could study it a little bit more and not draw a conclusion that it was a player. But yeah, it was fun to watch Connor this year and feeling like, to answer your question, that's what the question was about, living up to expectations. I think he lived up to expectations, even though he didn't hit the 84 points that I thought he was going to hit. I think he definitely lived up to expectations because of the media circus and all the off-ice obligations that he was pulled in so many different directions. And it's like, anytime the Blackhawks popped up on a schedule for the opponent, the main game plan was just stop Connor Bedard and you're going to win the hockey game, because they didn't have secondary scoring. And so for him to power through that and also find ways to like strap the Blackhawks on his shoulder as an 18-year-old, and just to do what he did as a rookie, like all the attention, like go the first five games of the season, it was four of the games were on national TV, and I was in every single one of those scrums. And it's like the scrum, I had never seen scrums that big before. And so this kid did that with all the pressure and all the attention. And I think he's going to flourish this next season, because he's not going to have to deal with all those distractions of, oh, Connor Bedard's in town, first game here, how's it been? Like, he could just kind of, I don't want to say blend in, but he could just be one of the guys, and it's not like a whole thing when he's playing a new team for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Now he has a full season under his belt, and now the team is looked like we were talking about, or like you were mentioning, trying to beef up the core around him or the supporting staff around him. And yeah, as far as Bedard, like after watching him last season, where would you say, I mean, obviously he was a rookie, so he's not perfect, even though he looked like it almost nights maybe, but like, what would you say were obvious sore spots, not sore spots, but just spots where it's like, he could definitely improve here, or now it's like, after he went through this full NHL season for the first time, things that you're looking at for him to be even better in this season? And again, I know we were talking about the supporting staff, or the supporting guys around him weren't great, or it wasn't the best situation maybe, so that probably didn't help, obviously. But just in his game, what are you kind of, I guess, thinking like, okay, here's where I expect him to even be better, as good as he already has shown to be so far?
Yeah. The one area I saw a significant improvement in him over the last season, it came on the mom's trip, where right before, it was like a few weeks into the season, and I think the coaching staff had said to Connor, they said, hey, we know when you have the puck, you are so skilled and you can do whatever you want with it, right? When he doesn't have the puck, I think they wanted him to be more of like an aggressive forechecker, and not that he was a liability defensively at all. Like, I actually was impressed by his defensive acumen. Like, he's selling out for blocked shots. Like, I don't think I ever saw Patrick Kane do that in Chicago, and that's not a slight to Patrick Kane. There's a funny clip that went viral a few years ago. I know Jimmy Hayes, God rest his soul, shared a story once of Patrick Kane telling him like, "Hey, get out of the way of a block shot. Like, that's not what you get paid to do." It's kind of like funny, and it's no slight on anyone,
right?
But like Connor is like he wants to win so badly that it's like, I'll go block this shot if it means us winning the hockey game. And so I admire that about his mentality. But it was on the mom's trip where you can go look at his goal. He had 6 points in two games in Tampa Bay and Florida combined. And a lot of those goals, he was a relentless forechecker, and he stripped the puck from a Florida defenseman. I think it was Oliver Ekman-Larsson. He stripped the puck from Nikita Kucherov. Like, he was the one going and getting the puck. It wasn't waiting on others to get in the puck. And I think that's where I saw a huge growth from him. It reminded me of, and I've shared this a few times on other outlets, but it reminded me of Alex DeBrincat when he had that down year. It was his second or third year in Chicago where he wasn't scoring any goals. Like, he wasn't scoring the amount of goals that he's used to scoring. And he went into that offseason he was working on his shot, but he was like, okay, if I'm not scoring goals, I want to be able to provide some other sort of element to my game where it's not just I'm one dimensional. And if I'm not scoring, then I'm of no use to the team. So he became a relentless forechecker. Later that year, he was probably, and I'm not saying this as an exaggeration, I honestly mean this, I think Alex DeBrincat was one of the best forecheckers in the NHL the next season. His goal total shot up again, back to the normal normal totals that he was used to seeing. And he was put on the penalty kill, and he was like an incredible part of that penalty kill as well. And so he rounded out his game where he wasn't just known as a goal scorer. It was like, oh, this guy also goes into the corners. He's battling hard. He's forechecking. He's playing on the penalty kill. I think that's where I saw the growth in Connor. He's probably not going to be on the penalty kill in Chicago very much, but I can see it being a situation where it's kind of like how Austin Matthews has rounded out his game. He's not just an elite shooter. It's like you see him battling in front of the net. You see him battling, going and stripping guys with pucks, like winning board battles. I think that's where Connor is going to follow that blueprint. And I already saw that growth at mid-season last year, or at post-mom's trip. And I think that's just going to take off even more next year.
Yeah, it's scary when you think about how great someone has already shown to be, or how good someone is, whether it's a rookie or now a guy going into a second year like Bedard, or even a guy like, let's say, Patrick Kane or Nathan MacKinnon, someone that's already great or looking to be great, but they're also looking how they can refine their game or just get better. And that's right. Kind of the scary thing, not to draw any kind of comps whatsoever, but it just makes me think of the great players of all time. Like, again, not saying they're going to be Michael Jordan, but like when you have that kind of guy that seems inflappable, and they can just dominate like every night, or at least have that winning at all costs mentality, and they know like whether they get beat or they have to overcome some kind of adversity, that they're able to rise to that occasion. It's like they're always fueled by something, and that's what those great players have. And yeah, I mean, I won't be surprised if Bedard, you know, assuming of course health and everything like that, if he just, you know, as great of a first season he had, just destroys it, like you were talking about Frank Cervalli saying he would have like a 100-point season or whatever, I don't know if I'd even be surprised if he hit at least 90, you know. Just is, but again, we'll see how it kind of works out with the guys around him. And how did you like the Hawks offseason? You were already talking about just they're more well positioned now around Bedard, and also to, you know, injuries pop up, and you get, you know, Teuvo Teravainen, and just, you know, then they bring in a big guy like Pat Maroon, you know. Just in general, like, what do you think about the offseason that they had? They signed what, 8 guys, I think, on July when the free agency opened up.
Yeah, they were very active, and I think we had an idea that the Blackhawks were gonna look to add more players around the younger players. I didn't think it was gonna be that much, like to that degree. And it was quality players too, like Tyler Bertuzzi and Teuvo Teravainen, like we mentioned. And I was looking at some of the defensemen too, Alec Martinez, TJ Brody on the back end, like they, Pat Maroon, like you mentioned, Craig Smith, more of a depth guy. Oh, and then Ilya Mikheyev, who they traded for. So it's these are like decent hockey players. They're not just fillers. Yeah, are Maroon and Craig Smith in the back nine of their career? Sure, but I think they're going to add a lot of value to the locker room, if nothing else, on establishing a winning culture, in addition with Nick Foligno already being there and some of the other veterans. So I think on the ice, here's what I'll say. Do I think they're going to make the playoffs or flirt for a playoff spot? No, I don't think so. Having said that, I think they're going to be far more competitive, where we're not going to see as many 5-1 losses for the Blackhawks this year. I think it might be closer to 3-2, 4-3, 4-2 with an empty netter. Like, it'll be close losses. Having said that, I also think the Hawks don't want to look at this year as another rebuilding year, like let's get a high draft pick. I actually do think they want to start pushing the ball forward here, and they want to start getting closer to the middle of the pack, so that maybe the next year or in 2 years they can really take off, and it's like, okay, here's the window. It is now officially opening.
Looking back over, I had the names all written out too. Like, yeah, Tyler Bertuzzi was a big time addition there. What about goaltending? Because isn't Laurent Brossoit, he's got the injury, the meniscus surgery that he had. So he'll be his time into October probably. But how do you like the goaltending situation?
I love what Kyle Davidson did at the goaltending position. Arvid Soderblom had a really difficult year last year. I actually really like him as a goaltender. I've spoken to people that have watched his progression over the last couple of years, and they thought very highly of him. And last year just did not go the way they thought it was going to go. And so I don't blame the Blackhawks for shoring up that backup position to make sure that it's not putting the entire team at risk of, you don't want the younger players to make mistakes, and then if the puck goes in the back of the net because of a mistake a defenseman made, but the goalie should have had it and it could have bailed him out. And now that the young defenseman doesn't feel as terrible about the mistake because the goalie bailed him out. So I think it was a situation where they wanted more of a 1A, 1B type employment with Mrazek and Brossoit. So I think we're going to see closer to like a 48-34 split. I think the math is correct there. A 48-34 split between the two, assuming Brossoit is relatively healthy at the start of the regular season. That's a really unfortunate timing of the injury. But I think when he is healthy and he gets back in the lineup, it's going to provide, like, you can throw anyone in net now, either Mrazek or Brossoit, and it feels like the Blackhawks are going to have a chance to win. And I think that's all they really wanted, is just give us an opportunity to win. Don't lose us a game. Just help us with our young players, provide some stability on the back end so that our younger players can have the freedom to make some mistakes and not feel like it's going to cost them in the back of their net because they're not getting the proper goaltending.
Yeah, and the Hawks have over 6 million cap space per Puckpedia, so I don't expect anything happening now between now and the season starting. But do you foresee any kind of, I don't know, there's always like those PTO type deals, maybe a guy catches on, makes it, maybe they don't. But do you see anything else, or is this roster pretty much, it's pretty much set in stone, I would think, right?
I think it's pretty much set in stone, mainly because I was trying to project the opening night roster, and there were a couple guys that I left out on my roster that maybe deserve to be in there, but I had no room for them. Joey Anderson was terrific down the stretch last season, playing in a shutdown role with Jason Dickinson. He was on the outside looking in, or Pat Maroon and Craig Smith. Like, one of those two guys, it feels like is going to be a healthy scratch on opening night. And so if you add another forward to the mix, I just don't know. Someone's going to have to be waived, and it's like, well, what are they signing for in the first place? So I think the roster is pretty set, unless injuries happen over training camp and maybe you got to bring a guy in, or whatever, guys are training and maybe they get hurt training, and now you're like, oh, we need an extra body in here. But I think if everyone comes in, if everyone reports to training camp healthy, it feels like that this is going to be the roster going into it.
What about the draft? Were you at the draft in Vegas last?
I was. June, incredible right? Experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it like inside the sphere?
I honestly, it didn't hit me until like I was walking there, but I got dropped off and then I was walking towards the sphere, like looking outside. I was like, I can't believe this is real. Because it feels like you just hear stories about the sphere and then it's like, oh, I actually get to go. Very, very cool experience. I mean, there were times where I like caught myself just like looking up and I was just kind of like not lost track of like what was going on. But this day two was actually pretty fun for me because the Hawks had traded in into the first round again. So they got a third first round pick and took Merrick Vanacker. And so they didn't have a second round pick going into day two, I don't believe. And so I was able to like settle into my seat for day two of the draft. And I was kind of just kind of had my arms crossed and I was looking around, kind of like taking in the moment, watching other writers scramble for a change, because it feels like every draft I was the one that was scrambling because the Hawks have always been so active at the draft. So it was just, that was a day two was much more fun for me as like to be able to soak it in. And so like to be able to like look at the fans and like just absorb the environment, it was a very cool. I selfishly wish Vegas was like the permanent spot for the draft at the Sphere, because that I would try to go back.
Yeah, no, it's really cool on TV, so I can only imagine in person. But what did you how did you like their draft as far as the guys that they selected? And do you have any, like, I don't know, I'm sure you've had plenty of one-on-one or at least some one-on-one or whatever interview time with some of these guys that have been, you know, drafted and things like that. Any like funny stories or just, I don't know, anything that kind of pops out?
Well, I think Artem Levchinov is definitely going to become a fan favorite in Chicago pretty quickly. He's from Belarus, but he has a very unique personality, and his personality itself is just very infectious. He's always smiling, even at the combine in Buffalo a few weeks before the draft. I had met him for the first time and he was just smiling. And then it's funny, there's a story. It was me, Ben Pope, and Scott Powers of The Athletic were in Buffalo for the scouting combine. And we were sitting in the stands getting ready to watch Levchinov do his, do the drills. And he's like getting ready to weigh in or whatever. And he kind of looks up at the stands to see who's there. And he looks at like all three of us. And he's kind of like, he waves like, hi, because he remembers that the three reporters that were waiting for him to come and talk to us, because he knew that we were Chicago guys. And so it was just like, oh, wow, he's already being very warm and friendly to us. And then he gets drafted. And I guess the story I'll share here is he goes through his entire media session after being drafted by the Blackhawks. And then it was like last question goes, and then it's like, oh, okay, like, thank you, Artie. We appreciate it. And he's like, oh, let's keep going. I'm finally starting to get comfortable. Like, cause you could tell like he was a little nervous at the beginning, and then like he wanted to keep going. Like he was literally ready to keep sitting in his seat, like to field more questions, but we just had run out of them. And so he's a character. I think Chicago fans are really going to enjoy him. As far as the overall draft, I think it's, listen, I'm no expert. I think it's easy for me to say, oh, this is a good pick, this is a bad pick, you know, whatever. But hockey scouts and management, it's such a different beast than if you and I flip on a college football game on Saturday and it's like, oh, you know, this player, Caleb Williams, he's a really good player. Like, I think he's going to be a top quarterback in the NFL. With hockey players, like, they're playing in Sweden, they're playing in juniors, they're playing, you don't know anything about them, you can't watch them, so it's hard for me to draw conclusions. I more so look at the overall approach, like, okay, what are the Blackhawks targeting? They're going for speed, right? This year they tried to fill out their center depth. They got Sasha Boisvert, who I think they're really high on. Merrick Vanacker, like, speed type player, high motor. So like, I see the qualities that the Blackhawks are going for, and that's how I basically judge their draft. Like, are they going for the high end players, the high ceiling players? Are they sticking to the script of going for speed, competitiveness, high hockey IQ? And if they do that, I don't really have a problem. In saying that, I think this past draft class is going to it's going to be looked at, because I know the Blackhawks were really debating between Levshinov and Ivan Demidov, and it was reported after late in the draft that Kyle Davidson attempted to trade into the number four overall spot with Columbus to take Ivan Demidov, and it was pretty close. Like, the Hawks made like a really strong offer, but Columbus passed because they wanted Caden Lindstrom. And so I appreciate the efforts that Kyle Davidson made in trying to go for both, because they thought very highly of both players. So I think in that regard, maybe years down the road, we're going to say, you know, did the Hawks make the right decision between Levshinov and Demidov? Who knows? But I don't fault them for taking Levshinov. That's actually the guy that I wanted them to take, just like if my opinion was worth anything, because I think you look at all the Stanley Cup winning teams over the last 15 years, the Blackhawks, they had Duncan Keith, all-around defenseman. Pittsburgh, Chris Letang, all-around defenseman. Tampa Bay, Victor Hedman, all-around defenseman. I just didn't see it on the roster or in the pipeline. Where was that number one overall defenseman? I think Kevin Korchinski can be a top pairing offensive defenseman. I don't know if he could ever, I don't know if he'll ever get to the place where he's out there in the protecting a lead with 2 minutes left. You know, like that might not be his strength. So Levshinov, to me, he's a guy you can throw out there on a power play, on a penalty kill, the last 2 minutes of a game. That's the number one overall defenseman that I see in him, or his potential. And so I think the Blackhawks made the right choice, or I guess they couldn't make the wrong choice by picking the defenseman that they think has the number one overall package versus like getting a winger. So it goes, you know, I don't fault them. If they would have taken Demidov, I would have said sure, I see it. Like, so I think that's where, you know, fans will be able to make that call down the road, like what was the right decision or not. But going back to what we were talking about earlier about, I also think environment is everything. Like, Demidov might, you know, if Demidov hits a wall in Montreal, how much of that is the environment? Did they develop him properly? Did they, you know what I mean? So it's there's so many layers to it so that hard. It's so hard to like judge one specific thing, or like, oh, this player was a bust. It's like, man, there are so many layers that you have to peel back. And so, very long-winded answer, but you know, that's the best I can explain it.
No, it's so hard to predict any of this stuff. I mean, when I try to write like some sort of preview on a prospect, it's like the best thing I can do is kind of see what the experts are kind of saying and kind of just, you know, try to piece something around that, because I don't know. I don't specifically know enough about these guys to say like, oh, here's what I think. Like, who cares what I think? But here's the best I can do to kind of like paint a story, or paint a picture rather, of you know, what could at least help fit that team's needs. Like you said, the environment is everything too. So also, I remember last summer we were talking about Kane and Taves, and obviously Kane in Detroit. And I think you, before that happened, you were thinking Detroit might be the team there. And of course that's what happened. But Jonathan Taves is still not retired, right? And I think, I know last season or last offseason going into last season, you said you didn't think you'd play last year. I don't even remember if you said this, but you were like, if anything, maybe he tries to play again after what is now last season now. But do you think he's going to ultimately, you know, officially retire here soon? Or do you think he's still going to try to come back at some point somewhere?
And I at this point, it would feel really hard for it to see a scenario where he gets back to playing, only because his final year in Chicago was, he was still kind of in and out of the lineup dealing with, you know, the health stuff, and his numbers were down too. And then you go a full year without playing, and now we're in, you know, going into September, and he's still not on a team. And I think the role that he would have to play for a team that is looking to bring him in would be a very, like, it'd be like third line checking role, and for like a low cost. And it's like, well, what, you know, what good is that to him? Like, he's, why? Yeah, like what's he going to do? Like, it would be different if he didn't have a Stanley Cup and he's like, man, I just want to chase it. But he's got three to his name and he was a captain. Like, I don't know, you know, if he has like a burning desire to play and he just wants to be dragged off the ice because his passion is hockey, and he just wants to play. I totally get that. Like, look at Jágr. He's, you know, 50 whatever years old, and he's like, I just love the game so much that I just don't want to stop playing. And he doesn't care what that does to his legacy if people remember him as like the older guy at 50 versus what he was in his prime. So I totally get that. Like, I respect it. But for him, like, if he doesn't have that, you know, then I don't think there's a purpose for him to want to come back unless he has like this burning desire to just want to play for as long as he can. He posted something on his Instagram a couple of weeks ago, and it seemed like he was doing pretty well. Like, he looks good. He came to Chicago last month for the Chris Chelios. He was holding like a camp here in Chicago, and he was smiley. He looked like good. He looked really good. Like, looked like he was in good spirits. So like, that's encouraging to see. So I hope post hockey life is treating him well, because I know Chicago misses him, the entire city. But it's nice. I think if anything else, we just want him to be healthy and in a good headspace.
Yeah, for sure. It makes me think of Gabriel Landeskog in Colorado. Like, it looks like he's actually going to come back, and we didn't know if that would, you know, be happening, obviously, with the injuries. So I'm curious to see how he plays coming off of, what is it, like two seasons without hockey?
Yeah, I think wasn't it the last year, the last game he's played was the Stanley Cup, right? I think it was. Yeah.
Going back to Bedard for a second, what is it like talking, I guess, I mean, I'm sure you've been able to talk one-on-one with him quite a bit. What is it like, how is he, I guess, being able to talk with him and, I guess, just picking his brain? Or he seems super serious anyway, but does he kind of have that personality that kind of shines through at times too?
He does. I see it. I definitely see it behind the scenes. I think when the cameras are on, it can be hard to portray the personality, because he talks almost every day or whatever, and his scrum is always the biggest. So he's always has to be protective of what he's saying, and he's really good at it too. Even I actually saw it when the season was playing out last year, that he started to open up more, like in his shell, like he started to crack jokes in the media and he was smiling. And so he's not some robot, but he's been in the spotlight for so long that he's like almost like conditioned to like,
yeah,
not want to say the wrong thing. And I totally respect that. Cause like, he's like one guy that you're really never going to have to worry about saying the wrong thing. Cause his heart is always in the right place. But yeah, he did start to open up. Or like, you could see behind the scenes, like he's got like a cool personality. And I've met his parents. Like, his parents are like the kindest people in the world too. So he comes from like really good family. And so I definitely see, like, you know, sometimes what you see on camera isn't what, you know, he has to put on the face, and he's sometimes fielding questions, sometimes bad questions that we ask too, and he has to find a way to navigate it in a respectful way. So sometimes it's hard to have your brain on like that and show some personality. I think over time we'll start to see it more and more as he gets more comfortable, you know, just within his place in the game. But he's a really good kid. It's funny though, because I don't have many one-on-one conversations with him, in large part because he is always the last person off the ice after a morning skate or a practice. And it's not just like last one off the ice. It is like last one off the ice by a mile. It's like we've been in the locker room for 20 minutes and he's still out on the ice. And it's like, we got to go upstairs because Luke Richardson's about to talk and we don't have time to wait for Connor. So it's like on days Connor does talk, it's like, you got to get the interview, then you got to go run up. And on the road too, there's a morning skate or a practice. It's like Connor's the last one off the ice. And it's like, hey, bus is leaving. And like Connor has to get going, get his stuff on, get showered, because everyone's on the bus and he's the last guy. So it's like, you don't really have those opportunities to kind of just sit and chat with him and pick his brain. Like Patrick Kane, like towards, you know, the last few years of his career in Chicago, I was able to have like really insightful, deeper conversations with him. And that was really nice getting to know him on more of like a deeper level and like his insight for the game. But Connor is just like constantly on the ice that it's hard to like actually get one-on-one time with him. So it's unique, but he really good kid. Like I tell people this all the time, mostly like my family and my friends. I'm like, if you could craft a hockey player, like talent and leadership, like as far as you know, you're never going to have to worry about him. Like that is Connor. Like he goes to bed at the right time. He eats the right thing. Like he says the right things in the media. He plays the right way on the ice. Like he's like the perfect hockey player as far as like total package and being like the face of a franchise. So he's been amazing, and it's hard to fathom that he like just turned 19.
Oh, I know, it's crazy. And I just remember when the whole like the Corey Perry stuff, whatever, went down in Chicago, and then there was all kinds of crazy rumors happening on Twitter without even getting into that. Him having to like absorb whatever, you know, stupid stuff that's being said on social media that's pertaining to him or family. I'm like, yeah, that's stuff that obviously, like you said, he's well conditioned to be able to probably stay within that bubble and at least just do his thing. But obviously it's not easy, but you definitely respect that they're able to, you know, they know the negative stuff that comes along with also the positive of media and social media and all kinds of crap in these days. And, you know, but one last thing, actually, I was curious too. So I see like when you think of Seth Jones as what he can bring to the team today, or like these days, I always see it on Twitter kind of from fans who like love or hate him just based on his game. And, you know, I remember in Columbus how he was as like kind of like Zach Werenski, a guy that could really, you know, help you offensively. Maybe there would be some defensive lapses, or, you know, you kind of not to say sacrifice one for the other, but, you know, that kind of risk in that kind of game sometimes as far as their style of play. But like, what do you I guess draw from a guy like Seth Jones and as far as what he brings to the Hawks today?
Yeah, two things. One, I think the critique of Seth Jones is more of it's like attached to his contract, right? So like his $9.5 million AAV, it's like if he's not performing at that level, it's like you hear it on social media. It's like, Seth Jones, he's getting paid this much and he makes this mistake, right? And it's like, well, you know, I think that goes hand in hand with the number, the contract. Like I remember Brent Seabrook at the end of his, when he signed that monster deal with the Blackhawks, like he was revered in Chicago. Like he was like an icon. He still is an icon, but like then he signs that 8-year deal or 7-year deal, whatever it was. And it's like, oh, now Seabrook is making the most money of any Blackhawks defenseman and he's on the decline and his performance isn't there. And now it's like fans are getting impatient because they're like, oh, like Seabrook made, you know what I mean? So it's kind of the same with Seth Jones. Like he's making so much money that it's like almost impossible for him to make a mistake. And also it was a weird time because he got like the Blackhawks gave up assets for him. So it wasn't like, you know, they drafted him and then he just became the highest paid player. It's like, oh, they acquired him for assets during a time where it was like a weird time in the organization because they're like, do we rebuild? Do we go for it? And then I was like, oh, okay, let's go for it. So like that added the wrinkle to it as well. But here's what I'll say. Seth Jones is a much better player than he gets credit for. I think his fault is not his own. It's the Blackhawks just do not have much infrastructure. They haven't had much infrastructure around him that it's almost like he feels internally like he has to do it all, because when he's on the ice, maybe he's got to cover for his partner or if it, like Vlasic and Seth Jones played really well together last season, but it's like outside of that, there wasn't much stability. So it's like, well, anytime Vlasic or anytime Jones is on the ice, he probably feels like I got to do it all because we don't really have other players that can kind of lead the charge. So I think for him, kind of like as the Blackhawks get more support around him and they start to build a roster and strengthen the roster, I think you're going to see the best version of Seth Jones, because then he doesn't have to worry about everyone else and he could just focus on his game, and he can trust that everyone around him is doing their job. Whereas like during a rebuilding team, it's impossible not to try to be the guy that's filling in everyone's spot, because, you know, it's they're young players and maybe they're out of position and then he has to go cover for them. And now you leave your defender in a tough situation because you decided to pinch. because you know that. So it's just I really like him as a player. Is he a perfect player? No, like by any means. Like there are definitely times where you're like, oh man, he had a tough game. But most of the time, there was a portion of the season last year where he was out with an injury, and when he wasn't in the lineup, you're like, oh, you're like, that's a lot of minutes that the Blackhawks need to fill, and one guy can't step into that role. It's like they needed to do it by committee because Seth Jones eats like 27, 28 minutes a night. And so when he's not in the lineup, you appreciate him more because you're like, oh, wow, you actually see his real value. And when he is in the lineup, you almost take it for granted because he can eat so many minutes and sometimes he makes mistakes, but that's going to be natural if you're playing 30 minutes a night. If you're playing half the game, you know, the more you play, the more opportunities you have to, you know, just be out there for maybe some negatives too, not only positives. So, but yeah, I like him as a player. I think sometimes the criticism is more directed at the contract and not really directed at him. But I think as the Blackhawks start to grow and the trajectory starts to be on the upswing, I think you're going to see a better version of him because he'll be able to play a little bit more freely, knowing that the guys around him are doing their job too.
Yeah, I liked him a lot in Columbus. I have his jersey, and then of course, you know, I was kind of glad when they made the move just because where the Jackets were, they needed to kind of fix up their core, and like you said, they made that trade and everything, so it kind of, I guess, helped both teams, or at least that was the intent. Frank Nazar, I was just thinking about him as well. He's another top prospect, right? That is this going to be his first full season in the AHL, most likely? Yep. Right? Because he hasn't played a game down there yet, right? Or was it like a few games last? That's what I thought. I was looking at it earlier, and I was trying to remember, it was either like one or no games yet in the AHL. So, I mean, it's hard to say like what his timetable could be as far as to like when he can make the NHL, especially with the roster. A lot of the moves they've made this past summer and everything, but like, I don't know, I guess never say never, and it's kind of a bad question on my part, but I guess it's like, could you see him somehow crack the roster before the end of 24-25, or are you thinking it's going to be at least this past this upcoming season before you'd see him in the NHL?
I think he's going to spend a majority of this season in the AHL, and maybe by the end of the season he could get called up, or towards the second half of the season he can get called up and maybe slots into more of a full-time role. But I feel like the 25-26 season is probably where he gets slotted in as like a full-time player, assuming that this year goes well and he continues to trend in the right direction. That would be my timeline for him, because then you got Oliver Moore coming, you got Sacha Boisvert, and you have all these young players that are going to start to make the jump. That I don't think you don't want too many young players in Rockford, because you want to start, you know, you want to move Nazar to the NHL after a year in the AHL to open up room for somebody else in the AHL. You know, you don't always want to have the same guy taking up the same spot. So I think that would be my projection for Nazar.
Yeah, I figured if anything, if he saw any NHL action this year, it would be like, you know, April or something like that. You know, that's what the Jackets have been doing the last couple of years, where a guy gets a game or two or three at the very end of the year. But yeah, I figured it was probably going to be at least another year. But anyways, yeah, that's all I had. Really cool to, again, chat some hockey with you and just see how things have been going after about a year or so. So glad to, sounds like everything is going pretty well overall. With everything on your end. So hopefully it's a good season, you know, coming up.
Yeah, definitely. Always good to chat with you. Hopefully, God willing, we could do it again next August, same time, and continue to be on the same track. So good to chat with you, Will. Hope you're doing well. And yeah, hopefully we'll do it again next year.
Three, two, one. 0 0 and liftoff.